in school. He started writing poems at 13, but he modeled his rhythms on the preachers he heard on the radio.
Detroit at the time was probably half Southern. And every Sunday morning you could turn on these guys, both white and black, and they would belt out language like I never heard. I loved it.
Levine, who's won virtually every major prize for his work, including a Pulitzer and two Guggenheims, is celebrated for evoking the richness of ordinary American life. Here's a reading from his poem, Call It Music.
The perfect sunlight angles into my little room above Willow Street. I listen to my breath come and go and try to catch its curious taste. Part milk, part iron, part blood, as it passes from me into the world.
Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to help reverse the childhood obesity epidemic at rwjf.org.
WILL programs are made possible by Amber Glenn Alzheimer's Special Care Center in Urbana. Amber Glenn offers programs designed to support residents' health and independence and to help them feel secure in their environment. More information is available at 384-0100.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is the second hour of the program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour. And we are very happy to have back on the program once again May Barenbaum. She is head of the Department of Entomology here at the University of Illinois. She is a scientist who specializes in studying insects. And when she is here on the program, we invite insect questions. Now, the caveat I always say is now, it's not about extermination. We have a guy for that, Phil Nixon, our buddy Phil Nixon, who we're going to try to get in here maybe sometime in the next couple of weeks because it's been a while since Phil has been here. Because there are times when if you have an insect pest problem, you have to deal with it. But that's not what we do when May is here. When she is here, we encourage you to call in and indulge your curiosity about insects. And we try to learn more about them and appreciate what they do. And one of the things that we've talked about a lot, I'm sure we'll talk some more about on this program, is how it is we could not get along without them, at least without some of them. So we'll talk about all these various and sundry things, and this is an opportunity for you to call in with questions about insects. Maybe you've seen one and you're not quite sure what it was, and you can give us a description, the best description you can that will help her tell you what it is. Or maybe you have specific questions about a particular insect, and you can do that. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And also you can email your questions to will-talk at illinois.edu. And you should go out and look for some of May's books. Let me just mention the two recent ones, Honey, I'm Homemade, which is about honey, and it has recipes, and it's a lot of fun. So if you're interested in cooking or if you're interested in honey. And then her other most recent is The Earwig's Tale, A Modern Bestiary of Multi-Legged Legends. So those are some of the things, if you like to read about bugs, you should look for. Thank you for being here once again. I should start by saying I'm really sorry that I don't know why we forgot you. Last time you were here was when we were talking about the festival, the film
festival. That's right. That was February.
Which would have been in February. And we usually think, well, it's warm and insects are around and people will be thinking about them, and so we should have you on. And I what can I say? I'm sorry.
Well, I might be among the, as I mentioned, when I saw you earlier in the week, I might be one of very few WIL listeners who sends in her annual membership donation with a "Why haven't you called me?" letter.
Oh no, actually, there are no. That's true. We're glad to. We're very glad to have you here. And you were here with. You were on. I talked a little bit on the Afternoon Magazine last week about some of the things that will be going on at the Pollinatarium, and we'll try to mention that again too. Maybe people didn't hear that. You're doing some things on Saturdays, and there will be several
Sundays. Yeah.
Oh, pardon me. Sundays. Sundays in August, every Sunday, there's a different sort of a thing going on. And so if people haven't checked out the Pollinatarium, that's pretty cool. So they can do that. All right. Well, I find we have many people who want to talk with you. Let's do that. So we'll start out. We have somebody in West Champaign, line number one, right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hi.
Good. So this is an insect behavior question for May Barenbaum. I think I had heard sometime that these little tiny gnats that sometimes fly in large clusters in the summertime in your garden and things like that, every year it's the same group, it's the same breed that have hatched out. And I don't know if that's true or not, but if it is, I've got a question about dragonflies. When we visit friends of ours that live on a lake, there every summer a dragonfly patrols the front of that lake, and its job is to protect its territory, and it chases off all other dragonflies that come in. And it's the same route all the time. Now, is that the same? Did that dragonfly's ancestors come from that area? Is that a behavioral issue or not? So I'll hang up and I'll listen to the answer. Thank you very much.
Okay.
So sort of a two-part question there, because the question is, do these swarms of mating aggregations, is what they tend to be, of midges and non-biting flies, are they, is it one generation after the next, or are they just coming in from everywhere? And the same, sort of a similar question about the dragonflies. Well, there's kind of a two-part answer, too. There are, for those sort of hovering aggregations, as far as people know, most people aren't that interested in pursuing the sort of ancestry or genealogy of non-biting flies. So whether they're exactly related to aggregations of past years, but it is almost certainly the case that there are certain physical attributes of that site that make it ideal for hanging out and waiting for females. So we don't always know what makes for an ideal location for these territories. And that's a similar situation with the dragonfly males, who do in fact patrol an area, and there are certain physical characteristics of areas that make them particularly either well defensible or very attractive to females, and therefore attractive to males to set up territories. One other group of insects where you see this kind of male territorial defense are the black swallowtail, or swallowtails in general, but the black swallowtail. And I came from upstate New York. I did my graduate work there, and a fellow graduate student had determined that the behavior of the black swallowtail is called hilltopping. The males go to the top of the hill. They come out 3 or 4 days before the female, and they set up territory. They literally play king of the hill, chasing away other black swallowtails. So when the females come out, they head for topographic relief, some sort of hill in the landscape, and then whatever male happens to dominate that hill, that becomes their mate. So I moved to central Illinois, and I thought, okay, what do hilltopping butterflies do here? There's no hills. What is it, grain elevators? What do they do? So it was kind of a mystery until I realized that a lot of hilltopping black swallowtails now patrol railroad rights of way, that tend to be sort of on berms a little bit higher, and they'll just now that might have created considerably greater mortality due to the Amtrak, the Saluki or the Illini or whatever. But another sort of endearing behavior of these incredibly aggressive butterflies. You don't really think of butterflies as sort of being aggressive, but they fight with each other. So I have a colleague who sent me a note saying, why did a black swallowtail in my backyard chase away a red-winged blackbird? And in fact, there are many records in the literature of black swallowtails chasing anything black and fluttery, including a black bandana hanging out of the pocket of a fellow graduate student who was studying the mating behavior of black swallowtails. So be forewarned, if you're in hilltopping territory, don't wear black. So you'll be molested by a butterfly.
Okay. And so then it's not this, it's just it's the location that's really important. It's not that the insects, whether we're talking about midges or dragonflies, it's not that they're genetically related to all the ones who have been there in the past. It's just, it's not about the individual. It's about
location.
Okay.
Just like in human real estate.
All right. Well, I hope that gets the question at the corner. Let's go to Champagne and line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Huh? I have a question about an insect. I think they're like a house centipede, but they I've seen them in houses, and they move. They have lots of legs, but they're very light colored, like a very light tan. And they move very fast. And I was wondering, what are they called, and where do they? What's their distribution, and what do they eat? And I'm presuming they're not dangerous. I've never heard anything that way, but do you know what I'm talking about? And what?
Yeah, actually, they're called house centipedes. Well done. They're not insects. Too many legs. Insects only have six. Centipedes. The name literally means hundred leg, but they don't usually have 100. And they're differentiated from millipedes because each pair of each segment bears one pair of legs, whereas in millipedes, they do have more legs, and they appear to have more because each segment is actually a fusion of two segments, and they have two pairs of legs. Now, the two pairs of legs per apparent segment in millipede slows them down. So if you have something in your basement that's running around quickly and has more than six legs, it is almost assuredly a centipede. And there is a whole family, the Scutigeridae, that these are the Scutigera is the house centipede. And you're right, it doesn't seem to cause much problem for humans. Centipedes all are venomous. They all produce that. In fact, their name Chylopeda means essentially poison foot. The poison is used to subdue prey. They don't. For the most part, here in North America, they can use it defensively, but it doesn't much matter. The world has very, very few really deadly centipedes, and you have to travel a long distance to find them. And I'm not sure why you'd want to. But, so they live in houses. They're not bad roommates because they chase down and devour other insects that live in houses that you might not want to share your dwellings with. The most common one around here is actually introduced probably from Europe, but is sort of cosmopolitan in distribution. It's one of these, it's traveled the world with people. But you described it perfectly. They tend to be light colored. They tend to have long legs. Millipedes have short legs, and they move very quickly.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Right.
And what do they eat?
Any small crawling animal that is smaller and slower than they are.
Okay,
so they're all predators.
As they just run them down.
Basically, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, very good. Line number three, and this is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a spider question see if you could possibly identify it and let me know if it's a friendly or not. This was on the outside of a house, and it's a beautiful spider. It has a teardrop-shaped body that's about a quarter of an inch, maybe a little larger, very narrow. And in a resting position, it looks like it only has four legs because the other four are shorter than those four, and he kind of tucks them behind the longer legs.
And it's in a web?
It's in a web.
Okay. And it's an orb web, right?
Yes.
So, you know, a big circle-like web.
Yes.
Yeah. I have to preface this by saying, I'm an entomologist. Spiders are actually not insects. So I'm not really good at spider identifications. But does it look like it looks like it has four legs because two pairs are pointing upward and two are pointing downward? Is that sort of kind of looks?
Upward, yeah. Two are pointing downward, yeah. And it looks like there are the extra four are tucked in behind the two that are
right.
Pointing up and down. Yeah.
And is it kind of a – what color would you call it?
There is a bright yellow.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call it a stripe, but I would say yellow and black mostly.
Yeah, that's – I think we are – today is the first day I've actually tried bringing electronic cheat sheets here instead of paper ones. So it's nice because then I
– She has her iPad. No funds have been exchanged between us and Apple for this promotional consideration.
But I don't know if you notice when I've been talking, I will slow down and say, I think what you're talking about, and I'm frantically turning pages. But what you've described is basically it's called the black and yellow garden spider, Argiope aurantia, really beautiful spider. It is yellow and black, and as I'm showing right here, looks like it has four legs that's really classic. And it's a very common spider around here. And it's big, I mean, as spiders go. And they make a very strong web. And I was beginning to feel fairly paranoid because these guys have been building webs around every entrance to my house. So every time I go out, I feel like there's some plot among the spiders out there to seal us in or something. Are you finding them near entrances to your...
Near an entrance,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the garden... That's the black and white, yellow garden spider. I don't think they're out to get anybody, but... you know, I think the reason they seem to be at every single one of the doors in and out of our house is that these doors will have lights. And when you turn a light on at night, in come all kinds of flying insects, which are sort of mildly entertaining to me, but very tantalizingly delicious to a spider. So I think spiders have a lot of success spinning webs, waiting for prey to come to them. So, well, if they're near a door. But it's a lovely spider, as spiders go.
It is beautiful.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
All right.
So
thank
much.
You. And as far as human beings are concerned, harmless.
Harmless, yeah. And again, essentially all spiders are venomous. They use the venom to subdue the prey, but only a very, very few have venom potent enough to affect humans and jaws strong enough to deliver that venom. So it's a two-part deal.
Mm-hmm.
This two-part deal is a source of many, many urban legends about arachnids in general, because one of which I stumbled on when I traveled to Australia, and we weren't there very long. Didn't want to drive on the wrong side of the road, and I didn't want to get lost. So we hired a tour guide, discovered I was an entomologist. He said, did you know that the daddy longlegs is the most venomous spider in the world, except that its jaws can't pierce human skin? And I was astonished, because that's an American urban legend. I guess it's global. The daddy longlegs,
they're actually not spiders.
Are not spiders, and most of them feed on dead stuff. And they do have defensive, they're called repugnatorial glands, glands that ooze out disgusting smells. But for the most part, they don't use venom to subdue their prey. And I was astonished to hear almost word for word, but a very different accent, the same urban legend that I've been hearing here. So what might be confusing is there's a family of spiders, sometimes called the daddy long-leg spiders, which have long legs, that are regular spiders, but they're not particularly venomous. Mm-hmm. Australia has tons of incredibly venomous spiders, but not venomous daddy longlegs.
All right, then. May Barenbaum is our guest this morning. She's head of the Department of Entomology at University of Illinois. She is a scientist who specializes in studying insects and is on the program every once in a while. We talk about insects, not how to get rid of them, but how to appreciate them, if that is possible. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455.
And by spiders, by insects, we mean anything with a lot of legs. So.
Well, open-minded. Technically, I guess insects, they all have, how many? Six? Six. So anything more than six legs is not an insect.
But it's okay, because
all right.
I'm open-minded.
Very good. We appreciate that. Indiana, next, line number four. Hello.
Yeah, a couple of things. One, when I found out you were going to be on, I flipped out my Eastern North America insect and spiders book, flipped through it and say, well, I've seen that one, haven't seen that one, haven't seen that one, seen that one. I wonder if you could just make a sort of a general comment about which insects are making it and which ones are not. I guess you could pull in the honeybee, too.
Uh-huh.
Second thing is, it's sort of a strange thing that I noticed the other day. I live in a town that's east of Purdue University. And they're beautifying downtown. One of the things they're doing is they're putting pots of flowers at the curb level on corners and also up maybe halfway up a light pole also. And unfortunately, the other day I noticed, and we're talking about the black swallowtail, one come whipping in and a big truck hit it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went, oh, Christ. You know, I moved up further, and then there was one right on the corner, and the traffic that was turning in front of me, I had the stoplight against me, were a lot of cabbage butterflies. And guess what?
Yeah.
The wind pulled them into the tire area, and they're gone. So I thought, hopefully somebody like you that has the reputation can explain some of these nuts that run these parts and stuff. You know, they got to consider the whole picture.
Yeah, that's a really excellent point. And actually, you asked about what insects are making it, what are not. Well, a lot of entomologists right now are kind of in the midst of a debate about the status of a very iconic insect, the monarch butterfly. It's the state insect of Illinois and I think six other states. And this is an iconic species, among other things, because it undertakes this heroic migration from Ontario through the Midwest, all the way down over 1,000 miles or more to several acres in Michoacán, Mexico, and a place where the physical attributes are perfect for spending the winter. It's pine forest of Oyamel. The numbers in the overwintering sites seem to be declining. But since there are billions, literally billions of butterflies, they're very hard to count. So it's not clear. The way they've been measuring them is just by how much area the overwintering roosting butterflies take up. In contrast, there are during these migration flights on the East Coast, there are stations, way stations, where people try to count them. Now, the counts in the overwintering sites suggest that the numbers are down. The counts along the East Coast suggest they're okay. And there's a raging controversy as to whether they are in, you know, whether this migratory phenomenon is endangered and whether genetically modified crops are contributing to the decline. Not the way you would think, not because the caterpillars are eating modified, genetically modified corn pollen, but because when farmers plant Roundup Ready corn and soybeans, they kill the weeds in their millions of acres of corn and soybeans, and milkweeds grow in corn and soybean fields. So the issue, though, what that really how that relates to your second question is, we got involved in a study of the impact of genetically modified corn and in the Midwest. At the same time, one of my students wanted to see how many butterflies are killed along Illinois roadsides every year. And the numbers are staggering. He walked by roads that had different amounts of traffic, different speed limits. But no matter, even in slow country roads, the death toll is staggering. And it's all kinds of butterflies. During the
footnote.
Yeah?
When I drive to the countryside, I drive around 20 to 25. I found out that most of the butterflies, even the small ones, can get into the airstrip.
Yep.
And they go over the back of the car.
Yep.
And oftentimes you see them flying away. I mean, they're confused, but still flying away.
Yeah, that happens during the migratory flights of the monarch. They also can end up in the sort of, I don't know if it's called a slipstream, but they'll get kind of sucked in, and if they're lucky, over. But you know, you just look at a grill and see that it is a major source of mortality for
aluminum moth.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Uh huh.
Haven't seen one in
years. They are, in general, the giant silk moths, the family Saturniidae, seems to be in decline. Nobody has much baseline information, but repeatedly, anecdotal observation all across the eastern U.S. has suggested these numbers are declining. And there was a study done in Massachusetts suggesting that the one in the contributing factor was the result, actually, the gypsy moth, which came in the late 19th century. People were desperate. It was absolutely devastating eastern forest. This species has a host range of about 300 plant trees. So at the beginning of the 20th century, every conceivable European enemy of the European gypsy moth was brought over, including a small parasitic fly called Compsellura concinnata. This is a family Tachinidae. These are flies that lay their eggs inside or on the bodies of other insects, and their maggots eat them.
Yeah.
Now, Compsellura concinnata will attack gypsy moths. Gypsy moths have one generation per year. Compsellura concinnata has multiple generations.
Yeah.
So they knew when they brought it over, it was going to need other species, and it turns out that these giant silk moths are great hosts for the parasitoid fly, and the suggestion is that maybe all across their ranges, these giant worm moths have been hard hit by the biological control agent, the beneficial insect that, you know, had a sort of friendly fire or collateral damage was in the decline of these giant silk moths.
Could you say that sort of crosses all kinds of things, like bringing in certain birds to take care of other birds, bringing in certain plants?
It's a tricky business, yeah. For the, you know, you can't. they didn't know back in the early 20th century.
Sure.
They're
sure.
now much, much stricter
they
standards.
They ought to know it now, by
yeah,
now.
They do. They
Thanks
do.
A lot.
No, thank you.
Very
you.
Nice.
Well, that's still, it's, you know, one of the things in looking for things to talk about, I guess one of the things that is really striking is the extent to which introduced species continue to be a problem. And that I think that I read somewhere that it's, somebody had estimated that we introduce 2 new insect species every year to the United States. And so often we have these problems because we have something that's come from another ecosystem. We introduce it in the United States. There are no natural predators. And so it just goes
It's the land
it
of opportunity.
Crazy because yeah. there's some kind of abundant food source. It's just fine in that environment, and there's nothing that's going after it.
Yeah, it's interesting because there was a fairly controversial paper that appeared in a very high-profile journal called Nature, where a number of very respected ecologists said, "What's all this fuss about invasive species? There are many, non-native species that have integrated well into our natural communities and provide useful ecosystem services." I think maybe they were not entomologists because. It's amazing how much economic damage can be laid at the 6 feet of invasive insects. When I was talking to David before we started, I said I always check Google News every day. I type in insect. I don't know how many other people have this in their Google News personalized news searches, but. And there's always insect news, and almost always there's a story that is prefaced with invasive. I don't know who came up with the estimate of 2 per year. I'm sure it's higher. We intercept more than that every year. The Capra beetle was just intercepted. This is an absolutely devastating stored product pest. You know, that those are pests that unwelcome, what's the word, additives to your breakfast cereal or, you know, these are the, you know, the crawling raisins, whatever. They cause enormous damage in grain elevators and flour mills, wherever there's broken grain and any kind of stored product. Actually, they'll attack textiles, fabrics, all kinds of things. There's one called a drugstore beetle, which eats medicine. I mean, everything, spices. It can eat cayenne pepper. You can breed these things in cayenne pepper. Anyway, we've been lucky to keep the Capra beetle out, but it does keep appearing at quarantine, at ports of entry. So, yeah, we are under constant threat of invasion.
Yeah. Well, we have some other callers here. We'll talk next with somebody on our line number 1, and this is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. I'm calling about what I think is a great black wasp. Actually, a dozen of them that are buzzing around some milkweed out front of the house I just moved into here in Champaign. It's a beautiful insect. It's about 1.5 inches long, all black with a bluish tint, and the legs dangle below the body as they fly. And I read that they feed on katydids, which we get in abundance here. I can hear them every night. Could you tell the audience a little about the great black wasp?
The great black wasp. I think it sounds to me like a Sphecid wasp, which are, for the most part, big black wasps. You can hear me. Here we go. Does it have a very thin waist or is it more sturdy? Uh-huh. Yeah. So they're all predators. The Sphecids are all predators, fairly, I don't know if you want to call them primitive or anything, great hunters. And many of them, take prey and paralyze the prey. This is what their venom does. They sting the prey until they're alive and not moving, and that allows them to haul them underground. Or actually, some of the wasps will build nests above ground and provision their offspring. So they'll take the paralyzed prey, lay eggs, and then the grubs will hatch and eat the still living prey. It's kind of it would be an awful way to go, I guess, if you were an insect.
Hope it doesn't happen to me.
No. Well, you know, if I couldn't have made it as an entomologist, I think I could have done all right pitching ideas for bad science fiction films because insect life cycles actually are pretty horrific when you know the details. Mm-hmm. If you're the, you know, on the receiving end of them. Really, I think that's why giant insect movies are so popular. It's the one thing people find tolerable about insects is they're not very big.
Yeah.
Because if they were big, they could do a lot of damage to us.
Can so, I ask, yeah. Uh-huh. Common in this part of Illinois?
What, Sphecid wasps in general? Or those?
Yeah. I've never seen them where I come from in central Minnesota.
Yeah, well, I've seen them every year here. Blue, black, shiny, lovely creatures. There's another family that's also blue, black, and shiny. I'm not doing well with my – I may just go back to the books. The pompilids, they're spider wasps, and they will do the same thing that your wasp is doing to katydids. They'll do the same thing to spiders. So that's another large black and blue – or bluish-black kind of wasp. Similar biology, though. The other very large wasps that people can spot this time of year that are – doing this hunting, not katydids, but they'll go after cicadas. These are the cicada killers, the largest eastern North American wasps. They're kind of yellow and brown, brownish black, and people get freaked out by them because the males are, as we were saying earlier, territorial, and they'll actually go after you. I mean, they'll just buzz at you. Males can't sting, but it is a little disconcerting to be, chased around by a hormone-crazed large wasp, even if it can't sting you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that we were just talking about this in our house the other day, and when my wife said something about seeing a wasp that looked like a military attack helicopter, and I'm thinking, well, that probably would be a cicada killer because they're the biggest wasp that you're going to see here, and that they do that thing. I guess, though, as soon as they – it's a territorial behavior, and as soon as this male cicada killer realizes that you are not another male cicada killer, then he doesn't care anything about you at all.
That's right.
That's the big thing. He's wanting to make sure that he's patrolling his territory and that he has no other males or competing for whatever females might be around in his territory.
And if you ever hear a cicada call that suddenly trails off into silence, that's probably what happened, is that a cicada killer came by and sort of paralyzed it in mid-trill.
We're talking this morning in this hour with May Barenbaum. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois, and we're taking your insect-related questions, not extermination ones now, please, but appreciation ones. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Hugh Herr designs artificial limbs, including the ones he wears, to replace the legs he lost in a climbing accident. They have a dozen computers and muscle-like systems.
My biological body will degrade in time due to normal age-related degeneration. But the artificial part of my body improves in time because I can upgrade.
Hugh Herr on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's programs are made possible by Champaign Cycle, 506 South Country Fair Drive, just south of Springfield Avenue in Champaign. Champaign Cycle's website, champagnecycle.com, offers information about the shop, including clinics, group rides, and shop events, plus links to biking for exercise, fun, and as transportation.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. We're here with different topics for you every morning. And tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we will talk about the Greek economic crisis and how it affects the European Union. Our guest will be Kostas Kourtokakis. He's a professor of political science here at the University of Illinois. And then in hour two, Celeste Quinn talks with Pamela Constable, a foreign correspondent, former deputy foreign editor at Washington Post, author of a new book on Pakistan titled Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself. You can check on the schedule by going to our website. It's wyll.illinois.edu. This morning in this hour of Focus, our guest is May Barenbaum. She is an entomologist. She's a scientist who studies insects, and she is, in fact, head of the Department of Entomology here at the U of I, and occasionally is on the program, and we talk about insects, and your questions are welcome. Again, one thing I want to make sure people understand is not extermination questions. We'll do that on another day. If you have, though, you want to engage your curiosity, that's something else. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, also you can email us at will-talk. At illinois.edu. And back to the phones. Our next caller is in Belgium. Line number two, right here. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you both.
Mm-hmm.
You've already kind of broached the topic that I was thinking about, well, I was going to ask a question about, and I'm still going to. You talked about the Luna moth, which is sadly disappearing rapidly, though every year I do see one or two, three, you know. Maybe it's because of the habitat I provide. But that gets to exactly the question I want to ask is, what is it that Luna moths eat? I had heard by, with no authority at all, that they like tomato plants. They're those great big worms that are on...
No.
I was going to say I was going to sacrifice my tomatoes for them, but I guess...
No. That's a totally different family. Oh. Although they're often confused. The sphingids and the saturnians. The sphingids are called the hawk moths. The saturnians are the giant silk moths. And they're probably confused because they're big. They're the biggest moths we've got. When you said eat, I was wondering because the saturnians, the adult moths, have no functional digestive system. They don't eat at all.
Well, I was meaning they're caterpillars.
Right.
Is what I'm talking about.
Yeah. The saturnians, for the most part, at least the ones around here, tend to be tree feeders. They feed on the foliage of a lot of different types of trees. Just want to get this right. And they feed on, among other things, birch trees, hickory, walnut, sumac. I don't know if you live in a wooded area.
Yeah, that's probably why I see them all the time, because I have a lot of walnut and butternut trees.
Yeah, that's probably what they're feeding on.
Yeah.
In contrast, the tomato worm, as it's sometimes called, is the immature stage of a hawk moth, very different body shape. The hawk moths have long, long tongues. They're pollinators. They fly as well as hummingbirds. In fact, there's one species that's called the hummingbird hawk moth. It hovers like a hummingbird. The larvae, the immature stages, there's some tree feeders. There's a catalpa hawk moth, for example. But the tomato, you know, as the name suggests, the tomato hornworm, as it's called, the tomato worm, feeds only on plants in the tomato family. And around here, those are all herbaceous. They're not trees. So, that's all big green caterpillars aren't necessarily going to turn into the same thing. A lot of people make that assumption because there's not that much that gets that big.
Thank you very much.
All right,
sure.
Thank you. And we'll continue. And next we'll talk with somebody in Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hi. I've been working at controlling invasive plants.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And I've talked with you before about one of them, which is the poison hemlock and whether there was a biological control.
Uh-huh.
And
yes.
You told me there was. And I tried to order some, but this is from Montana or something.
Yes,
like
yeah.
That. And the life cycle was not off. Was
right.
Not conducive to getting them. But then they turned up, and I'm actually trying to control them at a farm our family has in Ohio. And the moths turned up
on their own?
This isolated little patch. Mm-hmm. Then I heard the story. This was 2 years ago that I first noticed them. I heard the story shortly after, and you were part of it. I was on NPR, and it was called The Million Bug Highway.
Oh.
And they even had a cute, if you went on the website to listen to it, they even had a cute animated thing to go with it. It was really very interesting and gave me an idea of how they might have shown up in this isolated patch of stuff. But they keep coming back, and they keep decimating the new plants. Because there's a seed bank of the poison hemlock seeds in the soil. And so I've started trying to transfer the caterpillars to other large areas of the stuff. I'd started last year, and I tried again this year. The previous year, I didn't actually see any caterpillars. All I could see was the leaf curls. This year, my husband got impatient with my efforts, wanting the space to grow grass and control erosion. So he wanted to get rid of the poison hemlock faster than I was ready to. I got to keep enough plants so we can grow more of the controls. So we cut off a bunch of the flower heads, and I put them in a bag, and I was going to burn them. And when I went to burn them, I realized I was seeing little caterpillars crawling around. They're really quite tiny.
They're adorable.
Yeah. Pardon?
They're adorable.
Yes, they are. So I took all the bags of seed heads down to a huge patch, and I put the seed flower heads of the stuff I cut down with the uninfected plants, and I'm hoping that will work. I'm wondering how it would be best to bring some back here to infect the stands of the stuff that we've got around here. Do you have any thoughts about transporting these little caterpillars?
They live around here, actually. I'm extremely fond of this creature. It's called Aganopteryx austromeriana. And I'm not a very observant entomologist, nor am I a taxonomist, but they happen to eat poison hemlock, which is a plant in a family I'm interested in. And as a graduate student, I was the first person actually to report in the literature that these guys had made it over here from Europe. So it's a European insect. It is one of the very, very few plant-feeding insects that has only one known host plant. Insects are fussy. Most are a little less fussy than eating only one thing. And this all around the world where this insect has turned up, it only has one known host plant. And it's this noxious weed, poison hemlock. And then years later, so it was in upstate New York. It turns out I wasn't the first to collect it because a systematist there had put it in the Cornell collection a few years earlier. But and the only reason I noticed it, I was looking at poison hemlock. And then I came here and I found it here.
Okay.
And again, the only reason I found it here is that I was looking for caterpillars on these plants. And so they've been here since the 90s. They're, again, patchily distributed, but they are very reliable and they are uncannily good at finding even isolated plants, poison hemlock plants. So it's kind of an if you build it, they will come. How they got here is anybody's guess, because they first showed up in the East Coast. Then they were reported in Washington State on poison hemlock, then in Ohio, and then in Illinois over this 14-year period. And then there's a fellow in Missouri who's trying to get them established for biocontrol. And the guys out of Montana who try to rear them en masse, they don't have a factory for them. They go out and collect them, which is why they're not you can't really depend on having them when you need them. But they're here. They're definitely here. And this place seems to agree with them.
So are they beginning to be a big enough population to have an effect on the poison hemlock here?
Not that we've noticed, but poison hemlock is a hard plant to study because it grows in waste places. So you'll have a nice population, and then someone will get impatient, like your husband did, and pave it over, or plow it up. And so we've actually had that. We've been following populations, and then somebody develops or repaves or builds, and then the population. It's a very patchy plant because it depends on, what humans are not paying attention to. That's where it grows.
Well, there's a great population out of the Landscape Recycling Center.
That's actually, you mean on University?
At the Urbana.
Yeah.
Right.
Near, there's a park near there.
Right.
Yeah, that was one of our sites, actually. That's where we did an annual census for throughout the 90s.
Well,
you're right. They're very, very abundant there.
Well, I happened to notice some poison hemlock growing in our neighborhood, right between the street and the sidewalk, whatever you call that space. And the family had little kids' toys outside, so I went and knocked on the door. I said, you know what you have planted growing out there? And she said, I don't know what it is, but the city planted it.
No.
They've
really?
Taken down a tree and put in some mulch.
Oh, the mulch. Yes, that's how it would get around. Yeah.
Gorgeous crop of poison hemlock. So I said, I think you need to cut it down before your kids decide to eat the seeds or something. Because it looks like giant parsley.
And it has killed people in the past. It's what killed Socrates, actually. It contains an alkaloid called conine, which is a neurotoxin. I had a similar sort of, different outcome when I was up at Hardy's Reindeer Ranch,
mm-hmm.
where they raise reindeer. I was looking in the paddock where they kept the reindeer, and there's poison hemlock within easy grasp of the reindeer. I ran in there, you've got poison hemlock. And apparently reindeer who are accustomed to eating lichens, which are absolutely chock full of noxious poisonous chemicals, are unaffected by poison hemlock. So they knew it was there and didn't much care. So that was something I learned, that not everything will die if it eats poison hemlock. Certainly.
We have a bunch of other callers. Do you have time for
sure.
One more question?
Well, I do have two other callers,
okay.
And we're kind of short on time.
Okay, I'll talk to you another time about it.
Okay,
thanks.
You. I do also hear just this interesting. Here's an email I just wanted to mention. Someone wrote in and said that there's a plant at the Missouri Botanical Garden from Hawaii that is labeled as endangered because its pollinator became extinct.
Yes.
And the person writes, I think that now it's being pollinated by hand.
Yep.
And he was just wondering, are there other species like that in the continental United States that are endangered because their pollinators went away?
I'm sure there are. That one is a particularly tragic example, among other things. This is it's a lobeliad that grows along cliff faces, and the incredibly brave and intrepid botanists who hand-pollinate it have to rappel down the cliff to find these things. And interestingly, the pollinator was a Saturnia, a hawk moth. Like we were talking about the hawk moths that are good pollinators. And it may actually, its numbers, Franklin's hawk moth it's called, its numbers may have declined because of parasitic wasps brought in to control tobacco hornworm, which invaded Hawaii. So, again, it's a very complicated story and very sad. And there are examples around the world of plants that are disappearing because for want of pollinators.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go on. And we have just about 5-6 minutes here. We have a couple of other callers. Champaign County, next, line one. Hello.
Hi. My good news is that I've had a Luna moth for the first time in 10 years.
Wow.
And
aren't they pretty?
Isn't it something?
Yeah, they are amazing insects.
The bad news is that the local carpenter bees and bumblebees are absolutely gone. I have beehives, so I keep track of where my bees are foraging. I've got Russians, by the way.
Oh, wow.
And
they're supposed to be hardier.
They're doing rather well. I'm pleased with that. But the other pollinators are just absolutely gone. I live in the country, and I've got pasture and hayfield surrounding me, so I'm buffered from the spraying. But this is just tragic this year. There's nothing visiting the Russian sage or the oregano or the mint that usually draws a wide variety of pollinators.
You know, my colleague, Sidney Cameron, was involved in a study that provided incontrovertible evidence. It was based on surveys in 40 states and historic records, 78,000 historic collection records that clearly documented four species of bumblebees, two in the East Coast, two in the West Coast, are definitely in decline. I mean, there are climate deniers, you know, there are global change skeptics. There are also sort of, you know, extinction deniers and naysayers, but it is absolutely crystal clear that bumblebees are in trouble, particularly these bumblebees.
Yeah, the difference between this year and previous years is just stark.
Yeah.
I have tears in my eyes every time I go
sorry,
out and check to see where my bees are going.
Well, you know, keep those bees because we need bees, native or introduced.
Thank you.
Well, just real quick for the bumblebees. Now we have talked many times about colony collapse disorder and its effect on honeybees. Is it a disease issue? Is it somehow a habitat change
issue? That's the $3 billion question. I don't say more because Claire Kremen at Berkeley demonstrated that native bees, including bumblebees, contribute something on the order of $3 billion worth of agricultural pollination. They pollinate things that honeybees can't, including tomatoes. One thing in Dr. Cameron's study that was implicated there is a fungus called Nosema bombi that appears to be associated with decline, but they're still trying to figure out, you know, to lock that in. And another disturbing pattern that was found is these endangered, these declining bees have sort of eroded amounts of genetic diversity, which suggests that their populations are small, perhaps because of habitat fragmentation. So they're all kinds of hits, you know, death by a thousand cuts, really. Mm-hmm. That summarizes what's happening to pollinators.
We have one more caller here. I want to make sure I get line two in Urbana. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I have two quick questions, one about ants and the other one about lice. But
lice? Okay.
But first I wanted to ask, did you love the movie Ants?
There are two. I much preferred Bug's Life to Ants. They both came out in 1998, and DreamWorks Ants came out before Bug's Life, even though Bug's Life, which was Pixar, Disney Pixar, was sort of in the works longer. But I actually found Bug's Life a little more endearing than Ants. Well,
so you did get a kick out of it.
I absolutely love the fact that two of the top 10 box office hits of 1998 were feature-length animated films about ants. How it doesn't get any better than that.
No, that was a great year. my question about ants relates to fire ants, and I'll just ask you both questions and just hang up and listen. My question about fire ants, is there any chance that they can come up this far to live? And my second question is about lice. My poor granddaughters are suffering with it right now. And if a louse is living in a pillow or something, how long will it live there without feeding off of a head?
Okay, well, we'll do the second one first. Head lice are actually pretty wimpy as lice go, as human lice go. They do not survive long off their host. It's a matter of some discussion as to how long is not very long, but that contrasts with the body louse, which tends to live actually much longer off the host in the folds of clothing and the like. But head lice, for the most part, are utterly dependent on their hosts, and they will just not thrive for very long. But they do live long enough if you pass one hat to another, if you bump heads, that sort of thing. So it's not impossible to pass lice from one person to another on an article of clothing. But pillows, you should still wash everything, but they're not like lurking and waiting to recolonize once you wash your sheets. The other question was about fire ants. They're from the Amazonian area of Brazil and South America. And for the most part, they need water and heat. And unless global change accelerates things, our winter seems to be keeping us safe from fire ants. They haven't gotten much farther north than, I think, Memphis and Georgia. So be thankful for the next sub-zero snowstorm.
Okay. We're almost out of time. I just thought you might like to mention real quick about the some of the things you have going on at the Pollinatarium.
Well, this Sunday actually is a real treat. 2 o'clock, Gene Robinson, who is a real bee biologist, he's head of the University of Illinois Bee Research Facility, will be talking about citizen science and honeybees and how they've been involved. He has a number of research projects that have recruited people across the age spectrum, fourth grade kids all the way to seniors in the Osher Lifelong Learning program, and how really citizen scientists can make important contributions to understanding insect biology. We have every Sunday at 2 o'clock this summer, we've tried to have another guest or another activity. So the Pollinatarium, the south end of the Arboretum, is just off Windsor, 2 o'clock, and it's a great place to visit. I recommend it highly.
All right, very good. Mae Barenbaum. And I also recommend some of her books. If you'd like to read some of her writing about insects, you might look at The Earwig's Tale, A Modern Bestiary of Multi-Legged Legends, that came out in fall of 2009. And then last fall, the book that's all about honey and bees and cool things you can do with honey and all of its amazing variety. And that book is Honey, I'm Homemade, Sweet Treats from the Beehive Across the Centuries and Around the World. And sometime we'll have you back.
Do I have to make another donation to give us?
Well, we can discuss that. Mae Barenbaum is head of the Department of Entomology at University of Illinois. And is with us occasionally to talk about insects. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy Krannert Uncorked, a weekly free wine tasting almost every Thursday at 5 p.m. in the lobby. More information is available at krannertcenter.com.
That's it for us here on Focus. Up next is the Afternoon Magazine. The host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. We're online at will.illinois.edu. Let's take a look at commodity prices. In Kansas City, September wheat 774 and a quarter, up 11 and a quarter. December 798 and a quarter, up 11 and a half. September wheat in Chicago, 680 and three quarters, up 9. December, 712 and three quarters, up 9. September corn, 680 and a half, up 2 and a quarter. December, 690 and a half, up 2. March, 703, up 1. May, 708, up 1 half. August soybeans, 1297 and a half, down 1 1/4. September, 1291 and 3/4, down 1 1/2. November, 1298, down 1 3/4. In January, 1309 and a half, down 1 1/2. August soybean meal, 339.50, up 150. August oil, 53.13, up 10. August live cattle, 114.55, down 17 1/2. October, 118.05. Up 22 and a half. No numbers today again on feeder cattle. August lean hogs, 105.90, up 50.